Preacher stood in front of a rather substantial-looking brick building, looking up at the sign over the front door. The sign read, Philadelphia Police Agency. Unlike St. Louis, which had a constable and a deputy, Philadelphia had a well-organized police agency, consisting of constables, wardens, and watchmen. The watchmen patrolled the city from watch boxes, which were scattered throughout the town. Preacher went inside, where he was met by a man who was wearing a domed hat with a badge.
Yes, sir. Can I help you?
Yeah. I'd like to speak to whoever's in charge.
That would be Chief Constable Dolan. May I tell him what this is about?
Yeah. I think I know who's doing all the killings here.
Do you now?
What's your name?
I'm Constable Coleman.
Well, Constable Coleman, are you going to tell the Chief Constable that I'd like to see him?
And just who do you think is doing the killing?
I'd rather give that information to the Chief Constable.
Well, now here's the thing. You are the 10th person to come in here with an idea as to who's doing the killing.
I am. Have that many people heard of Ben Cavanaugh?
Wait a minute. You really know who this is?
Well, I know Ben Cavanaugh, and I know that he's killed like this before, and I know he's in Philadelphia because I followed him here.
You followed him here?
From St. Louis.
Wait here. I'll tell the Chief Constable you'd like to speak to him.
Thank you. A moment later, Coleman returned and escorted Preacher to a room in the back of the building.
I'm Chief Constable Dolan, and you are?
Folks call me Preacher.
Well, Preacher, Constable Coleman here tells me that you know who our murderer is.
Yeah, I do. Or at least I think I know.
Well, which is it? Do you know or do you think you know?
Preacher told him the story of his quest, beginning with the fact that he was a mountain man and fur trapper who had come back to St. Louis when he learned that a female friend of his had had her throat cut by a man named Ben Cavanaugh. She was killed in the same way as the four people in this city were killed. That is, if the details in the newspaper article are correct.
And from that, you've concluded that this Ben Cavanaugh is the person we're looking for?
Yeah.
Other than the fact the woman in St. Louis was killed by having a throat cut, and the victims here were killed by having their throats cut, what possible connection can you make? One event took place in St. Louis, which is at least 1,000 miles from here, and the other events took place here in Philadelphia.
There was a similar event in Alexandria, Ohio.
Where is Alexandria, Ohio?
There's a town on the Ohio River between here and St. Louis. Two people, a husband and his wife, had their throats cut there.
And you think the person who killed the two people in Ohio is the same person you're looking for?
Yeah, I know it is.
How do you know it's the same person?
Because there were witnesses to that murder. The two people who were killed were Mr. and Mrs. Potter, and their son and daughter saw the killer.
Oh. Oh, my. They mean to tell me those two children saw their own parents killed.
Yeah, well, they weren't children exactly. The boy was 17 years old and made a pretty credible witness. There's no doubt that the person he described as the killer's Ben Cavanaugh.
What a shame they should have to witness such a thing. But how can you be certain that the man they described is the one you're looking for? I mean, just in a general description.
Oh, this was more than just a general description. Turns out that when Cavanaugh attacked that woman in St. Louis, her dog chewed off his ear.
I'd be damned. So what you're telling me is that you've come to Philadelphia to look for a man with one ear, who also happens to be cutting down our citizens like a scythe through wheat.
Yeah.
All right. Suppose I believe everything you're saying. God help me, I think I do believe you. What makes you think that this Cavanaugh person you're looking for is even in Philadelphia?
Because I think he's here to extort money from Theodore Epson. He used to be a banker at the River Bank of St. Louis. Now he's with some bank here. Preacher went on to explain how Epson had stolen money from Jenny. When Jenny started making trouble for him, I believe he hired Ben Cavanaugh to kill her.
That's just about the wildest story I ever heard. Chief, I apologize for bringing him in here to see you. I thought he might have something, but he really is clutching at straws to put all that together and say that we're looking for the same man.
I'm not so sure, Coleman. As crazy as it sounds, I think it might be exactly the way he says.
So what are we going to do? Start looking for a man with only one ear?
Why not? At least it gives us something and someone to look for. That's better than chasing after a ghost.
Yeah, I guess you do have a point there.
I intend to search for him as well. Preacher showed Dolan the letter that had been given him by Constable Billings back in St. Louis. Dolan looked at the letter for a moment.
Well, I'm afraid this letter won't have much authority with any of our judges here.
No?
No. But I can take care of that.
Chief Constable wrote something on a piece of paper, then signed his name.
I'm making you my special deputy. This will give you authority to act in Philadelphia.
Thank you. Ebsen had never seen or even heard of Preacher, but when he saw Preacher come into the Trust Bank of Philadelphia, he had a feeling about him immediately. The man wearing buckskins was tall and muscular, like someone who lived and worked in the wilderness. Ebsen had seen several such men when he was in St. Louis, and if this man was from St. Louis, that couldn't be good. Ebsen watched as the man spoke to someone, then with a sinking feeling, he watched the man approach his own desk. Your name is Theodore Ebsen?
It is. And you are?
Preacher.
Preacher?
That's all you need to know, Ebsen. Jenny was a friend of mine. In fact, she was a very special friend, if you get my meaning.
Jenny?
Yeah, Jenny. You remember her, I'm sure. She's the young lady you stole $950 from.
I did no such thing.
The hell you didn't. Both Mr. Ashley and Jenny gave you the money to pay off her mortgage, and you kept it.
There are no signed papers anywhere to support that claim. You would never be able to prove that in a court of justice.
You just don't understand, do you, Ebsen? I don't need to prove it. I only need to believe it. Because I'm the only justice you'll ever see.
What are you going to do?
Oh, I don't intend to do anything just yet. You're my bait.
Your bait?
I'm a fur trapper, Ebsen. I don't catch my quarry without using bait. And right now, my quarry's the man who killed Jenny. Things didn't work out quite the way he thought they would. So it's my bet he'll be looking you up. Since he's already in Philadelphia, all I have to do is keep an eye on you. Like I said, Ebsen, you're the bait.
Ben Cavanaugh is in Philadelphia?
I didn't say a damn thing about Ben Cavanaugh. At first, Ebsen thought he'd been caught. Then he smiled as he remembered that Miller had said Cavanaugh was the murder suspect in Jenny's case.
No, you didn't say anything about him, but our Mr. Miller did. Mr. Miller just returned from St. Louis. He told me about the tragic events surrounding Miss Jenny. And he said that Ben Cavanaugh was the prime suspect. So, naturally, when you said the murderer was in Philadelphia, I made the connection.
Did you now?
Yes. How else would I have known that you were talking about Ben Cavanaugh?
I just can't imagine, Ebsen.
What makes you think Cavanaugh is in Philadelphia?
As he passed through Ohio on his way to Philadelphia, he killed a man and his wife by slitting their throats. And there have been four more killed here by having their throats slit. I believe that killer's Ben Cavanaugh. Involuntarily, Ebsen put his hand to his own throat.
Well, what I don't understand is why you think he would want to look me up.
Like I said, things didn't go well for him back in St. Louis. I think he's coming to see you in order to ask for more money.
I'm sure that I don't know what you're talking about.
Is that right? Well, you will soon enough. Ben Cavanaugh was sitting at a table with three others in the Bucket of Blood Tavern. He no longer resembled the man who had arrived in Philadelphia nearly 6 weeks ago. His hair had grown long enough to cover the missing ear. And with the money he took from the men he had killed, he bought clothes that were more in the style of the average Philadelphia citizen. Because he was now blending in with the others, he no longer drew curious stares from the casual observer. He was still rough-looking. No more rough-looking than the men who were sitting at the table with him. To the degree that a person like Cavanaugh could make friends, he had befriended these three. Several times over the last few days, he had encountered them here in the Bucket of Blood Tavern. Like Cavanaugh, none of the three men seemed to have any visible source of income. Cavanaugh bought a round of beer for
him. I need to find me somebody. I don't reckon none of you know a fella by the name of Ebsen, do you?
Yeah, I know a fella named Ebsen.
The man who spoke went by the name of Jim Gray.
But he probably ain't the one you're looking for.
How you know he's not?
Because he's one of them bigwigs that works in a bank.
Yeah. The fella I'm looking for works in a bank. He's got to be the same man. Where's the bank?
Well, there's a lot more than one bank in Philadelphia. What you need to see him for?
He owes me money.
Does he now?
Yeah.
What's in it for me if I tell you which bank you want to go to?
I'll give you a dollar.
Make it $2, and you got yourself a deal.
All right, $2. But for that, I want you to take me to him.
You got yourself a deal. Let's go.
Ebsen had stepped out to the privy behind the bank. When he returned, he saw two men standing by his desk. But as there was nothing unusual about their looks or demeanor, he approached them without any sense of concern.
Yes, gentlemen, may I help you?
Hello, Ibsen.
Cavanaugh, what are you doing here?
I took care of that little job you had for me back in St. Louis.
Shh. Who is this?
This is Jim Gray. He's a pal of mine. Now, about that business in St. Louis.
Let's step outside to discuss this. I don't want everyone listening into our business.
All right.
The three men walked outside, then stood in front of the bank.
What are you doing in Philadelphia?
I need more money.
I paid you a fair price.
Yeah, well, things didn't go the way I thought they would.
Yes, I know, I know. A dog chewed off your ear, but that's your problem, not mine.
Shit! Is that what happened to your ear? A dog chewed it off?
It ain't funny, Gray. How'd you know about my ear?
The preacher told me.
Preacher? Where did you see Preacher?
I saw him here, in my office, yesterday.
What the hell is he doing here?
He's after you, Cavanaugh.
Cavanaugh looked around, his face clearly reflecting his fear at the mention of Preacher's name.
How'd the son of a bitch know I was here?
He followed you here from St. Louis.
What's got you so spooked? You that scared of a preacher?
He ain't a preacher. What'd you tell him?
How could I tell him anything? I didn't even know you were in Philadelphia.
Oh, this is bad. This is real bad.
Maybe not. Not if we're smart.
You got an idea?
Oh, yes. Would you like some more money?
Well, hell yes, I would. I told you that's why I'm here.
All right. I'll pay you some more money. And I'll pay you as well, Mr. Gray. All the two of you have to do is take care of Preacher.
What do you mean, take care of Preacher?
This was Epson's moment of truth. He had danced around being a thief, and he had danced around the responsibility for Jenny's death. Things had gone too far now. It was time to fish or cut bait. And the way he saw it, the preacher had left him no choice.
I'll give you $100 apiece to kill him.
$100? Hell yeah, I'll do it. How hard can it be to kill a preacher?
I told you, he's not a preacher. He's gonna be a hard man to kill. I've run into him before. $100 ain't enough, Epson. You gave me $100 to take care of your problem in St. Louis. Taking care of your problem here is gonna be harder.
He's not just my problem. He's after you, too. Think about it, Cavanaugh. You're going to have to face him one way or the other. This way, at least, you're getting paid for it.
$100 sounds good to me.
Make it $120.
Why $120?
Gray, you think Scott and Kelly would throw in with us for $10 apiece?
Yeah, if we don't tell them how much we're getting. But you really think we're going to need them?
I told you. This preacher is one tough son of a bitch. We're going to need them. What about it, Ibsen? $120 apiece?
All right. But not until the job is done.
We've got to have some of the money now.
I'll give you $10 apiece now, plus $10 for each of your two friends. Come back to me when the job is done, and I'll give you the rest.
All right. But try and hold out on me when I come back, and I'll slit your throat from ear to ear.
I won't cheat you.
The lobby of the Federal Hotel had a red carpet and was dotted here and there with potted plants, chairs, and benches. Coming in off 4th Street, the stairwell to the upper three floors was to the left of the lobby, while the registration desk was to the right. When Preacher returned to the hotel from lunch, written in chalk on a slate just inside the door was a sign that read, "Mr. Preacher, to the desk, please." Preacher picked his way through the potted plants. The clerk was making entries in a ledger. He looked up as Preacher approached. "I'm Preacher?"
"Yes, sir. This was delivered for you, sir."
The clerk handed Preacher an envelope. "Thank you." Preacher climbed the stairs to his room and sat in the light of the window to examine the envelope. There was no name or address on the outside. He withdrew a one-page letter.
"Dear Preacher, shortly after you called upon me, I was visited by Ben Cavanaugh. I confess that I did ask him to frighten Jenny so she would stop making false claims against me. But I did not ask, nor did I expect him to kill her. Now, just as you said he would, he has asked me for more money. I told him that I would not give him any more money, and took him to task for misinterpreting my instructions. He grew very angry and threatened to kill me if I did not comply with his demand for more money. Therefore, it is for my own safety that I tell you where to find him. He has made camp in the park area of Kensington, very near a place known as Elephant Rock. It was in this same area that the first of our recent murders took place, and I am now convinced that Cavanus was responsible for those terrible killings. Therefore, were you to take care of him, you will not only achieve justice for yourself and your lady friend, but peace of mind for the citizens of Philadelphia, who are now too frightened to leave their homes at night. Theodore Epson.
Preacher didn't believe for one goddamn minute that Epson's instructions to Cavanus had been misunderstood. He was convinced that Epson had wanted Jenny killed. And he was equally convinced that this wasn't a letter giving up Cavanus, but instead, a letter designed to set Preacher himself up. He was certain that once he showed up at the park in Kensington, he'd be ambushed by Ben Cavanus.
Well, forewarned is forearmed. Preacher still intended to keep that rendezvous.
If Epson had gone so far as to set Preacher up for an ambush, then Preacher was sure that the banker had even more surprises in store for him. Therefore, before he left the hotel that night, he had prepared himself for any eventuality. He had two pistols loaded and stuck down into his belt. He also had two knives, one on his belt and one stuck down into his boot. Thus armed, he entered the park. There was no moon, so it was very dark, even more so because the park was some distance from the ambient light of the city. Although he was in the middle of a great city, Preacher was more at home right now than he had been at any time since leaving the mountains. He was in the middle of a wilderness, albeit a small one, listening to the ebb and flow of the sounds, moving with, not intruding upon, the natural order of things. As he approached Elephant Rock, he noticed something that not one other person in Philadelphia would have noticed. There was a slight disruption in the sound patterns made by the night creatures, and that disruption told him that someone was very close and watching him. The hackles stood up on the back of Preacher's neck, and he eased one of his pistols from his belt and cocked it. Hitting the ground, Preacher rolled quickly to his right as the bullet shot by where he had been but a moment before. Preacher raised his weapon. Remaining on his belly, Preacher crawled forward until he reached the body of the man he had just shot. Rolling him over, he saw that the man was dead. He also saw that it was not Ben Cavanus.
Did you get him? Scott, did you get him?
Shut up, Gray! The son of a bitch got Scott! Scott is dead!
Kelly, Gray, quit your jabbering and wait for a shot!
Cavanus! I'm coming for you, Cavanus!
Come ahead, you son of a bitch!
Preacher saw his bullet strike sparks as it hit a rock. He knew at once that he hadn't killed Cavanus. The best he could have done was to send shards of bullet or rock into him. That was painful, but certainly not fatal.
Kelly! He's already fired twice! Unless he's carrying a whole bag of guns, he's got nothing left!
Let's get him!
Suddenly, two men jumped up from their place of concealment, no more than 30 feet in front of Preacher. Preacher filled his hands with his two knives. He waited until they had closed within 10 feet, then suddenly stood up in front of them.
There he is!
Here I am!
Now, Preacher was effectively unarmed. Both pistols were empty, and both knives expended. He dropped behind a rock, then moved quickly and silently to his left in order to reload. But unknown to Preacher, the cowardly Cavanus had already left the park and run off into the night. Cavanus had only one thought in mind now, and that was to find Epson, get his money, and get the hell out of Philadelphia. And the only way Cavanus knew how to find Epson was to return to the bank and stay there all night long. When Epson showed up for work the next morning, Cavanus would be waiting for him. The next morning, Theodore Epson stepped down from the omnibus in front of the bank. Nattily dressed in a suit, vest, and hat, he walked toward the front door. As he passed a flowering shrub, Cavanus suddenly stepped out into the path in front of him.
Cavanaugh, what are you doing here?
Cavanaugh looked bad. His face was cut and swollen where shards of Preacher's bullet and rock had cut into it. He smiled, showing stained, crooked, and broken teeth.
Well now, is that any way to greet an old pal?
We aren't pals.
Cavanaugh put his hand over his heart.
Well, now that hurts my feelings something awful that you don't consider us friends. But I'll just have to live with the pain. Now, give me my $200 and I'll be on my way.
Did you... That is Preacher dead?
No, Preacher ain't dead. But Gray and the others are. Your heart looked to be around. You know that, Epson? First Slater gets himself killed back in St. Louis and I get my ear chewed off. And my new pards that I met here got themselves killed last night. Three of them. They was three of them and one of me. So that we was 4-1 against Preacher. But that didn't make no never mind. He killed all three of them.
Four of you against one man and he got away?
Yeah. So you see, Epson, I figure the best thing for me to do is just get the hell out of Philadelphia. Only I can't do that if I ain't got no money. So I'll take that $200 you was gonna give me.
That money was to be dispersed only if you killed Preacher.
Cavanaugh pulled his pistol.
Yeah, well, you're gonna disperse it anyway.
Preacher had eventually realized that Cavanaugh had gotten away from him somehow, sneaking out of the park under the cover of darkness. Preacher dragged the bodies of the three men he had killed into a spot that was some distance from the normal pathway people took when walking the park. Then, he had gone to the headquarters of the Philadelphia Police Agency to report upon the events of the night before. Chief Constable Dolan, Constable Coleman, and a couple of the watchmen, including one whose watch box was very near the entrance of the park, were there to listen as Preacher told his story. Accepting a ride in Dolan's carriage, Preacher led him into the park and to the place where he had left the bodies this morning. They were still there, undisturbed.
That's Jim Gray, Luke Kelly, and Martin Scott. They're the dregs of society, three of the most disreputable men in the city. If they are out here in the park in the middle of the night, you can bet they're up to no good. Preacher, you did the whole city a favor by killing these three.
Thanks, but the one I wanted got away. At that moment, a constable on horseback came riding into the park at a gallop.
Chief!
What is it, Smith?
A banker has been taken prisoner.
Taken prisoner? What do you mean, taken prisoner?
A fellow by the name of Epson. Witnesses say another man jumped out from behind some bushes this morning and took him at gunpoint down to the river.
Epson? Chief Dolan, if Epson's been taken prisoner, then Cavanaugh has to be the one who took him.
Come on, let's get down to the river.
Down at the river's edge, Cavanaugh had commandeered a small paddle boat. Ordering the boatman to build up the steam, he stood there, pointing his pistol at Epson, while a crowd of curious onlookers began gathering around to watch the unfolded drama. A Philadelphia watchman, whose watch box was close by, arrived to find Cavanaugh standing in the paddle boat, holding a pistol pointed at the head of a very frightened Theodore Epson. The watchman moved to the edge of the crowd.
Mister, my name is Constable Marvin Jensen. Just what is it you're planning on doing?
I'm planning on killing this son of a bitch if anyone comes any goddamn closer.
You don't want to do that, mister. That'd be cold-blooded murder and you'd hang for sure.
You want this man to stay alive?
Yes.
Then you go to this here fella's bank and you tell the person in charge there that he had better come up with $200. No, make that $1,000. You tell the bank it's gonna cost them $1,000 to keep me from killing this little pissant.
What makes you think the bank will pay $1,000 to save this man?
Because he ain't just anybody. This here fella works for that bank. I reckon they'll pay to save him.
Cavanaugh, Mr. Fontaine is never going to agree to something like that. He won't pay $1,000. He won't pay $1.
Then you're gonna die.
Cavanaugh looked toward the boatman.
How much longer before we have steam?
Not much longer.
Hurry it up.
You can't make steam any faster than you'd make steam.
Holding the gun in one hand, Cavanaugh pulled his knife with the other.
Well, you better figure out some way to do it or I'll split you open like I'm gutting a fish.
Mister, I swear it won't be much longer.
Better not be.
The bank has got until this fella gets the steam built up to come down here with my $1,000.
What if they don't get here before the steam is up?
Then you'll be leaving with me. Leastwise till I figure out what to do with you.
drama continued to play out on the banks of the Schuylkill River, the boatman working hard to build up the steam while an ever-growing crowd gathered to see what was going on.
Steam's up!
All right, let's go.
Go where?
Downriver, as fast as you can make this thing go.
No! Wait!
Wait for what?
The bank! You haven't given them enough time!
They ain't gonna bring me no money, you done told me that yourself!
At that moment, the carriage arrived at the river's edge. Three men got out of the carriage. Cavanaugh didn't recognize two of them, but he did recognize the third. He was Preacher.
Damn, the son of a bitch did get away last night. Hurry up, let's go!
The boatman cast off, then opened the prop.
Come on, let's get out of here!
The paddle slapped at the water, and the little boat moved quickly out into the stream. As the space between the boat and the river's edge widened, Cavanaugh began feeling more and more secure. He was gonna get away after all.
Hey, Preacher! What are you gonna do now, huh? Are you gonna keep chasing me?
Just until I catch you.
Yeah, well, you better give it up. You're getting too many people killed. Your woman in St. Louis, them two back in Ohio, the ones here, I killed them all. But you're to blame for it, Preacher. You're to blame because you're chasing me. As long as you keep coming after me, the more killing I'm gonna do.
Did you hear that, Chief? He just admitted to being the murderer we've been looking for.
Yeah, I heard.
Well, what are we gonna do about it? He's getting away.
There's nothing we can do right now.
The boat was now mid-river and making its way downstream. With the brisk current and full power, the little boat was moving much faster than a horse could gallop.
Holy shit, he just killed Epson!
Glancing back toward the carriage, the Preacher saw that there was a rifle in the boot. He walked over to it, picked it up, and examined it for a moment. Glancing back toward the carriage, Chief Constable saw Preacher with the rifle.
What are you doing?
I don't intend to just stand by and let him get away from me this time.
Are you joking? He's already out of range. By the time you get that rifle loaded, he'll be well out of range.
Maybe, but I aim to try. Out on the boat, which was now some distance from shore, Cavanaugh stood on top of the cabin, looking back toward the landing. The figures were growing smaller as the distance widened.
I'll beat you, you son of a bitch! I'll beat you!
Cavanaugh saw Preacher walk down to the water's edge, kneel, and aim a rifle at him.
What do you think you're doing, you ignorant bastard? You're too far away!
Oh, shit.
Cavanaugh lurched forward and then pitched over the side. His body rode the wake of the boat for a few moments, then slowly sank out of sight. When Preacher reached the top of the summit, he stood there for a moment. Gazing down on the vista, he saw an endless slope of mottled treetops, from various shades of green to golden aspen to crimson. Across a rolling basin, there was a wall of red rock, broken along its face into points, ledges, cliffs, and escarpments. An early fall snow had already crowned Eagle's Beak, and once again, Preacher saw feathery tendrils of snow streaming out from it. The crystals glistened in the sun, forming a prism of color that crowned the beauty of the scene. How different this was from Philadelphia, St. Louis, or even Kansas City. There, amidst the buildings and the clatter of traffic and the crowd of people, Preacher had been totally out of his element. Even while visiting his family, though he was pleased to see him after so many years, he had felt a nagging discontent, a need to get back where he belonged. Well, what do you think, dog? You happy to be home? I almost left you with Carly, you know. She begged me to. But I figured with that restaurant I bought her, she'd have her hands full. Besides, I missed you. Well, hell, if I didn't have you to talk to, folks would think I was talking to myself. The The First Mountain Man 10, Preacher's Justice, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2004, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Karen Carbone, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, M.B. Van Dorn, Andy Clements, James Lewis, Kate Torrey, Michael Glenn, Johann Detweiler, Dan Smith, Eric Messner, Peter Stray, and Lily Beacon. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Original musical score composed and performed by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Preacher's Justice, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's Eagles, Blood Bond, and The Last Gunfighter series, available from Graphic Audio and Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Now keep listening for another hard-driving episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator. It'll get you home.
Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator. Book number 2, Reefer Madness and More Tales of the Open Road by Ido Van Belper. Copyright 2008, Ido Van Belper. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode number 5, Reefer Madness.
After Mark Dalton delivered his load of bottled water to a food service distributor in Winnipeg, he considered giving his ex-wife a call to find out how she was making out on her ride back to Toronto with Mick, the toothless truck driver. But as his thumb swept across the keypad of his cell phone in search of the on button, he imagined her screaming at him about how he'd left her all alone at the mercy of a grimy man with more fingers than teeth. That kind of abuse he could do without. Besides, after he called her, he'd have to speak to his dispatcher, Bud. And when it came right down to it, he had finite capacity for abuse. And if he was going to endure it, he might as well get it from Bud.
Yellow.
Hey, Bud. It's Mark.
Mark who?
Mark McGuire.
Sorry, pal. I don't know any Mark McGuire.
For crying out loud, Bud. It's me, Mark Dalton.
Oh, Mark Dalton. Hey, what's wrong with your cell phone?
Nothing. Why?
I've been getting calls from your ex-wife every half hour.
Yeah?
From what I can tell between the screaming, she's pretty pissed with you. Says a guy named Mick keeps giving her the creepy eye.
Huh. Well, sucks to be her, I guess.
Yeah. Well, what do you want?
Oh, how about, I don't know, a load?
Ah, the pickings are slim at the moment, my friend.
You must have something.
What do you know about reefers?
They're great icebreakers at parties.
I'm serious here.
Okay, I don't know anything about reefers.
I never stopped you from taking a special load before. Well, these guys seem desperate for drivers and paying 30% over the usual fee for this sort of load.
Why are they being so generous? Does it have anything to do with mad cow disease?
I don't know.
30%? They still can't get drivers?
They said they needed dependable drivers they know can get the load to its destination no matter what. When I heard that, well, I naturally thought of you.
Naturally.
So you want to take the load or not?
Sure, why not?
Bud gave him the details. The company was named Better Beef and was based in Regina, Saskatchewan. He'd have to bobtail it there, then take on a chassis and reefer container filled with frozen beef, headed for Vancouver and ultimately Japan. Mark got off the phone and headed for Regina. After stopping for the night outside of Wolseley, Saskatchewan, Mark was able to easily make it into Regina for his 8 a.m. appointment at the Better Beef loading dock. As he made the turn off of Lawrence Street into the Better Beef yard, he noticed that directly across the street was a markedly newer operation called Best Beef. The building looked as if it had been recently constructed, and every truck and trailer in the yard was a late model, painted in gloss black with the Best Beef logo on it and the company name in bright yellow 10-foot-high letters down the side of the trailer. It was an impressive-looking operation, and their trucks had to be the envy of most of the drivers in the province. Looking at Best Beef, it was no wonder Better Beef was having trouble finding drivers. Best Beef had set up shop across the street to steal the business away from Better Beef by paying the best rates and offering the best benefit packages in the industry. It was a good strategy in the short term, but if Better Beef held on long enough, the new operation might stretch itself too thin to continue without filing for bankruptcy protection. Mark only hoped that if it was Better Beef that went under, they held on long enough for his paycheck to clear. It took 10 minutes to find the shipper's office, but when he did, the large man behind the desk named Voyek seemed thrilled to see him.
Are you the Mark Dalton?
Yeah, as far as I know, I'm the only one.
Good, good, come in.
You have a load for me?
Yes, I have a load. As many as you want.
Just one would be fine for today.
Voyek nodded.
One today, one next week, one next month.
Why are you having so much trouble getting drivers?
Well, driver is responsible for load. Well,
that's not different than a lot of other loads. Besides, you guys have insurance, right?
Of course.
So what's the problem?
A reefer load is different. It takes extra work from the driver, and how much work depends on the condition of the reefer container.
Mark looked out the window at the containers lined up in the yard. They weren't brand new like the reefers over at Best Beef, but they didn't look all that run down either. The oldest container in the yard couldn't be more than 5 years old.
You've got some pretty good equipment out there. Breakdowns shouldn't be a problem.
Not all drivers are like you, Mr. Dalton. They don't want to take chances on load.
But the money you're paying is good, right?
There had to be a catch here, somewhere. Voyek outlined the company's pay rates, and they were just as Bud had explained to him over the phone.
Well, I guess I'll be taking a chance on a load.
Excellent!
Voyek led Mark out onto the loading dock, where workers were packing frozen meat into the rear of the reefer container backed up to the loading dock.
How much do you know about reefers?
I know they're fun at parties.
Okay, well, anyway.
Voyek began explaining the setup and operation of the reefer container from checking the oil to inspecting the belts, from the basic operation of the control system to the procedure for defrosting the coil. After a half-hour crash course in reefer operation, Mark's head was spinning. It all seemed straightforward enough, but there was a lot of information to assimilate at one time. He hoped he could remember it all, but a greater hope was that nothing would go wrong with the reefer on this trip.
Now, if unit shuts down completely...
Why would it shut down completely?
It shouldn't, but you never know.
Mark was dubious, but he supposed it was best to cover all the bases.
Okay.
If unit shuts down completely, this time of year you got about 2 hours, maybe three, before the outside heat starts to affect load.
What happens after 2 hours?
Then the outside of the load could start defrost and you get damage.
Mark nodded.
That happens, you call me, and I send a man to fix it.
Woyek handed Mark his business card.
But it's a pretty new reefer unit, right? It should be fine.
Yes, should be fine.
Minutes later, they finished loading up the reefer. The temperature was set at minus 40. The seal was put on the container, and Mark was given all the papers he would need to connect with the yard manager on the docks in Vancouver. By 11 that morning, he was back on the road, confident that everything would be fine. After all, the reefer was humming away behind him like a long hauler, the load was frozen solid, and it was an easy run into the port of Vancouver. What could go wrong? But as he ran Motherload up through the gears, he noticed a long black Best Beef truck pulling onto the highway behind him.
Huh. Wonder if he's headed to the coast too.
By the middle of the afternoon, Mark had reached Swift Current, Saskatchewan, home of junior hockey's Broncos. After missing out on lunch, Mark's stomach was telling him that it might be a good time to stop for a bite to eat. So he pulled off the Trans-Canada into the first greasy spoon he saw that had a lot big enough for trucks. After shutting down Motherlode, Mark did an inspection of the reefer, checking the inside temperature against the set point, which were within a half a degree of each other, and the amount of fuel in the reefer tank, just over 3/4 full. When he was sure everything was running fine, he headed off to the restaurant for lunch. Mark ordered a chicken sandwich and fries and washed it all down with a hot cup of coffee. But instead of heading back to his truck right away, Mark hung around the restaurant, waiting to see if he might need a visit to the bathroom before getting back into his truck for 6 more hours. Turns out he did, and when he emerged from the bathroom 10 minutes later, he felt lighter, refreshed, and ready to hit the road. As he exited the restaurant, Mark could hear his reefer unit humming from across the parking lot. The diesel engine on the chassis was running smoothly and everything seemed to be fine. Until he got a little closer. While the diesel engine was still going, all of the temperature controls were off.
How could that be?
Mark glanced at his watch and figured he hadn't been in the restaurant for more than 30 minutes. Of course, something could go wrong with a computerized control system in a matter of seconds. But something told Mark that this wasn't a simple mechanical or computer error. A quick inspection of the controls proved him right. The controls were off because they'd been turned off. Mark didn't understand. He'd heard of drivers switching off other drivers' reefer diesels at night to cut out the noise so they could get some sleep. But why would someone want to shut off the controls?
What the hell's the benefit of that?
Mark didn't have an answer. So instead of dwelling on the matter, Mark simply turned the controls back on and dialed the set point in at minus 40. The interior temperature read minus 32, which meant the load was still frozen solid, but had lost 8 full degrees in half an hour. That change in temperature had happened a lot faster than Voyek had told him it would, which meant that in the event of a shutdown, Mark would have more like an hour and a half before the load began to spoil. That was good to know, especially since Mark had a feeling there might be more things going wrong with the reefer on this trip. He watched the interior temperature gauge slowly begin to count down to minus 40. And when he was sure it was going to reach the set point, he decided to head back onto the highway. He climbed up into the driver's seat of Motherlode.
Just my luck.
Or was it? In the lower left corner of his outside mirror, Mark noticed a long black rig parked off in the opposite corner of the lot. The big yellow Best Beef letters on the side of the trailer were unmistakable.
Wonder if he's having as much trouble with his equipment as I am. Maybe I'll ask him if I see him.
A few moments later, after making himself comfortable, Mark put Motherlode into gear and headed for the highway. Behind him, the Best Beef rig got back onto the highway as well. Mark reached the outskirts of Calgary by dark. Usually, whenever he drove through Alberta, he made sure to stop at a steakhouse for an inch-thick T-bone, but his experience at lunch made him wary of an extended meal away from the truck. Instead, he opted for a cup of coffee and an apple fritter, saving any full meal he might have for the morning and daylight. The lot at the truck stop was big, easily accommodating 100 trucks or more. But as much room as there was, Mark wasn't about to take any chances. He drove to the farthest corner of the lot and parked his rig next to a stand of trees. That way, he'd be far enough away not to bother anyone, and the nearby trees would act as a sound cushion, absorbing some of the noise before it could bounce back and make its way across the lot, disturbing all the sleeping drivers. When he had Motherlode in just the right spot, Mark inspected the reefer to make sure everything was running smoothly. He still had more than a half a tank of fuel for the reefer, but the interior temperature was off by 2 degrees at minus 38. It wasn't much of a difference, but because the night was going to be a warm one, he decided to defrost the coil so the refrigeration unit could work at peak efficiency through the night. The coil took less than 20 minutes to defrost, and when he switched the unit back on, it immediately began working to get the interior temperature down to the set point of minus 40.
Now we're talking.
In the morning, he'd order a breakfast to go, top up all his fuel tanks, and he'd be back on the road along with the sun. Mark awoke to the sound of silence. Not silence exactly, but silence accentuated by the peaceful sounds of birds chirping and the distant noises coming from vehicles rolling down the highway across the lot and on the other side of the truck stop.
Oh, man, it sure is peaceful. Nice and quiet. Wait, quiet? Oh, shit!
Mark scrambled out of his sleeper and nearly tumbled out of his truck in a rush to get outside. A quick check of the trailer revealed that the reefer unit wasn't on. Neither the controls nor the generator. Nothing. It was as if it had all been shut down, especially since there was more than enough fuel left in the tank for continued operation. Mark took a look around and saw that the lot had filled up during the night, and there was a box trailer pulled by a Kenworth parked right next to him, not more than 10 feet away. Obviously, the driver of that rig had shut down the unit last night so the noise from the thing wouldn't disturb his sleep. Mark went over to the truck.
Come on out of there, you son of a bitch! I know you're in there, and I know what you did, too!
Slowly, the Kenworth began to rock back and forth, and seconds later, there was someone looking down out of the cab at Mark.
You shut off my reefer!
The man slowly got out of the truck, his movements hampered by the veil of sleep that still hung over him.
Did you, you bastard?
The man turned to face Mark, and Mark knew he could have been a bit more cautious in his dealings with unknown truckers. The man had to be 6'5", 250 pounds. He wore a tank top that showed off the tattoos down the length of each of his arms. His hair was cropped short on top, but was long in the back with one of the worst mullets Mark had ever seen. There were rings in and around both of his ears and on each of his hands, and his boots were tipped with what looked to be chrome steel spikes. The buckle on his belt suggested the man's name was Vernon.
What's your problem, man?
Vernon stepped forward and cast a shadow upon Mark.
My reefer, it's off.
I know. I parked here around 3 a.m, hoping the sound of the engine would help me sleep. It did for a while, but I woke up when you shut it off around 5.
I didn't shut it off.
Well, somebody did.
And that somebody wasn't you?
Vernon just looked at him.
Well, thanks.
I sit on it and twirl, Barbara.
Vernon sneered at Mark, then climbed back into his truck. Mark looked around for another possible suspect and considered banging on the door of another truck, but he didn't want to push his luck. Besides, it didn't matter who had shut him down. What mattered now was starting it up again and getting the temperature back to the set point. Mark went through the steps just like he'd done before, and the reefer unit responded perfectly.
Nothing wrong with the unit.
And luckily, the interior temperature wasn't off by more than 10 degrees. Another disaster averted. Mark headed for the restaurant, wondering why, if he had to be so lucky, all that luck had to be bad. The restaurant was just about like every other greasy spoon he'd ever eaten in, offering a breakfast special of 2 eggs, bacon or sausage, hash browns, and a coffee for less than $5. Mark ordered sausages, scrambled eggs, and asked that the hash browns be replaced by toast, on account of his heart was only being able to handle so much grease at one sitting. Mark found an empty table by a window and turned the chairs around so he could watch his truck while he ate, just in case. Breakfast arrived a few minutes later, and Mark dug into what was a fairly tasty breakfast as far as roadside fare is concerned. After finishing off his eggs, Mark started in on the sausages. Before he had his first bite, an old-timer came up beside him and smiled at him with a sort of goofy grin.
Can I help you?
The old man, wearing a Rough Riders ball cap and a t-shirt from some wheat collective, just smiled at him.
You're driving for better beef, eh?
Yeah?
You crazy or stupid?
Mark pulled back slightly at that, looking the man square in the eyes. What the hell kind of question was that, he wondered. But the longer he looked at the man, the more the man kept smiling. Obviously, the question wasn't meant to be an insult, but perhaps a good-natured jab. Mark decided to humor the man.
A bit of both, I guess.
Yeah, you'd have to be a bit of both to drive for them guys.
Why? What's wrong with better beef?
With better beef? Nothing. It's them other ones you gotta worry about.
Mark was having trouble following the old man, like he was talking in riddles. The old-timer looked like he was about to be on his way, but there was a lot Mark wanted to know before he let the guy slip through his fingers.
Hey, you hungry? I'd be happy to buy you breakfast if I could ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
Have a seat then. And tell me what you know about Better Beef.
The old man slid into the seat across from Mark, still allowing Mark a partial view of his truck over the guy's shoulder. Mark quickly ordered another breakfast, and the old man began eating without missing a beat.
Better Beef's a good company. An excellent company. It's been around for ages, and their meat's some of the best you'd ever want to eat. But they're having a real old-fashioned range war with Best Beef. Now, Best opened a shop across the road from Better about a year ago, and they've got all kinds of money. But their product ain't so good. So, instead of working to make themselves better, they've been trying to make Better Beef worse.
So the two companies are having a big fight, huh?
This ain't no Pepsi challenge kind of war either. This one's a knockdown, drag 'em out kind of brawl.
Mark was silent, wondering just what he'd gotten himself into.
You have trouble with your reefer?
Yeah.
And it's a spanking brand new one too, right?
Yeah.
And you probably had a Best Beef truck following you west all the way from Regina. That right?
Yeah. But how'd you know?
How do you think? I was hauling a load for them, about 3 months ago. New reefer, great pay, everything perfect about the whole deal. Except by the time I'd reached the coast, I'd had so many problems that half the load got turned back for hamburger meat and dog food.
So all of the stuff that's been happening to me...
has happened to just about every other poor slob who's been crazy or stupid enough to take a load from Better Beef.
But that means...
sabotage.
You've gotta be kidding.
Nope. Let's just say that Best Beef doesn't exactly do much of a background check on their drivers. In fact, a criminal record is probably a bonus as far as they're concerned.
Mark could feel his hair start to bristle down the back of his neck at the thought of some thug using him and Motherlode to put a legitimate company out of business. What made it even worse was that there were good-paying loads just waiting there for truckers to pick them up and haul them away. But they were turning them all down out of fear over what somebody might do to them, their truck, and their livelihood.
Damn it.
Drivers had enough trouble making a decent living these days without worrying about their next load possibly being their last.
Well, that would explain it then.
Been having trouble?
Yeah, the whole way.
And you still ain't there yet.
No. There's still a long way to go. Well, I better be going.
Thanks for the meal. But just don't do anything stupid.
Mark looked at the man, wondering if he knew what Mark was like, and had heard of some of the crazy stunts he'd pulled in the past.
This little feud ain't worth your life.
I'll keep that in mind.
Mark exited the restaurant and returned to Motherlode. When he was halfway across the parking lot, he realized things were too quiet.
Oh, God damn it!
After just a few steps, Mark realized that the reefer once again stopped running.
What now?
A quick check of the unit revealed that the fuel tank was empty. That, of course, was impossible, since there had been plenty of fuel in the tank before he'd gone inside, and even a quarter of tank would have lasted 4 to 6 hours, maybe even more. Obviously, someone had drained the fuel tank on purpose. Mark was about to ask himself who might do such a thing, but now it was obvious. The driver of the Best Beef truck had been shadowing him since Regina, and had sabotaged his reefer at every stop. But how could he have done it so quickly without punching a hole in the tank? Obviously, the people at Best Beef had trained their drivers in guerrilla tactics, and no amount of inspection, precaution, or care was going to stop them from making life difficult for Better Beef drivers. No wonder they can't get anyone to haul for them. Who needs the hassle? Most drivers would just move on to the next company instead of putting up with that sort of crap. Then again, some drivers enjoyed a challenge. Some drivers felt right at home in a good old-fashioned range war. Some drivers you just don't mess around with. Drivers like Mark Dalton, owner-operator.
All right, let's dance, you cheap low-life bastard. I'm gonna stop you one way or another.
Now that he knew the score, Mark had an idea or two about how to stop Best Beef from getting the better of him and the company he was hauling for. Mark could have gone further, but he decided to stop in Kamloops well before sundown to give himself enough time to make sure he had everything he needed and everything in place. Years ago, before Mark bought Motherlode and headed out onto the open road, he'd worked as a private detective specializing in divorce cases. The money had been pretty good, but the job entailed a lot of nights and weekends videotaping wives and husbands through motel windows so the tapes could later be used in court as evidence or as leverage for a better settlement. Most of the time, it was a simple matter of setting up a camera, making sure he got a few clear images of the party in question, and then packing up and collecting a check. Then one night, the last he ever worked as a private detective, Mark was following the wife of his bank manager. But instead of learning that the bank manager's wife was meeting with some young stud, he discovered that the person in bed with the woman was none other than Mark's own wife, Jenny. That was enough of the detective business for him. After that night, he knew he'd never be able to videotape another cheating spouse as long as he lived. So he quit the business and got a divorce. Then he sold almost everything he had and bought his beloved Motherlode, the only woman in his life who had yet to let him down. There were a few things Mark hung on to, like his set of 1972 hockey cards, his ceramic Batman piggy bank, and his Sony Digital Handycam. It was an excellent tool for private detectives because it was small, lightweight, and had a night shot feature which made it possible to record images in the dark. The cameras could also be hooked up to sensors, which turned on the recorder only when there was something moving in the frame. That little feature and info-lithium batteries that lasted over 4 hours each made the Handycam an invaluable tool for catching someone in the act. Someone like a Best Beef driver vandalizing a Better Beef truck. Mark scouted the truck stop parking lot for the best location and decided on a spot directly behind the fuel station that had everything he needed. To the right was some bushes and a stand of trees where he could set up the camera and tripod without them being seen from the lot. In addition, there was a huge overhead light sitting atop a pole about 50 feet over the truck. Although he could tape in darkness, it was always better to have some light to record by. In the dark, smart lawyers argued that it wasn't their client on the tape, while light removed all shadow of a doubt. Mark set up the camera at dusk, trying to spend as little time in the bushes to avoid suspicion. When a driver did walk by, Mark took a step back from the bushes and pretended to be relieving himself against a tree. When the man was gone, Mark finished setting up the camera, making sure to get all of his rig in the frame. When he was satisfied that he was set up as well as possible under the circumstances, he stepped out from the bushes and pretended to be zipping up his pants, just in case someone had been watching him and wondered what the hell he'd been doing. After that, it was just a matter of waiting for the sun to go down. He headed into the restaurant for a coffee and picked up a copy of the Kamloops Daily News. When he'd finished his second cup of coffee, he was done reading the paper. The sun had fully set behind the mountains to the west. That meant it was time for Mark to take a little tour of the parking lot. As he expected, the big black Best Beef trailer was parked at the opposite end of the lot, tucked in behind a row of tankers. Mark didn't know if the driver was in the cab or not, but it really didn't matter. In fact, it would suit Mark's purposes even better if the driver was in his truck and knew Mark was checking him out. Mark walked around the Best Beef rig twice, taking his time and looking for something he could do as sort of payback for all the grief he'd been given since leaving Regina. He could switch off his reefer, change the set point, maybe even let the air out of his tires. But all of those things could be easily fixed. Mark needed something better, something that would cause the driver some real trouble. He checked the seal on the back of the trailer and saw that it was the thin metal band type that clicked into place and rusted over on trips across the ocean. This type of seal was a lot easier to break than the ceramic button type Better Beef used on their trucks. Button types required a pair of bolt cutters, and drivers didn't usually carry those with them on their runs. Of course, the Best Beef driver just might have bolt cutters in his truck, but Mark was willing to bet he didn't. After a quick look left and right, Mark took out his pocket knife and set about cutting the seal on the Best Beef rig. It took some time, but eventually he was able to hack through the metal and pull the seal from the trailer. His pocket knife was ruined, but thinking of the damage he'd done, the cost of the knife was a small price to pay.
First of all, without the proper seal, the load could be turned back by the customer, and that would hurt Best Beef in the pocketbook, right where they'd feel it most. And secondly, a missing seal would probably infuriate the Best Beef driver and provoke him into doing something extreme in retaliation. And that was exactly what Mark wanted. So Mark returned to Motherlode and noted that the Reaper unit was running perfectly. Then he climbed into the cab and stretched out in his sleeper, looking forward to a good night's sleep. He was not disappointed. Mark awoke the next morning to utter silence. His plan seemed to have worked, but he had to be sure. He climbed out of his truck and made a quick inspection of the trailer. The seals on the doors were still intact, but the unit had shut down because of all of its oil lines had been cut at some point during the night. He ran into the bushes and checked the tape made during the night. There were various shots of people walking past on their way to the restaurant, and then an extended segment in which a man in black, wearing a Best Beef t-shirt no less, climbed all over his rig, working furiously on the hoses connected to the reefer. The images were so good that Mark could even see the oil spurt and spray as he cut the lines that were under pressure. Mark's grin was from ear to ear. Hopefully, the guy's got a change of clothes with him, he thought, as he packed up the camera and loaded it into his truck. When he was all ready to leave, Mark pulled out of the lot without breakfast. On the way to Vancouver, Mark was on his cell phone constantly, first calling Voyage, then asking directory assistance for numbers in both the city of Vancouver and the surrounding suburbs. It would take a couple of hours for Voyage to send a repairman to service the reefer, and it had probably been 2 or 3 hours since the unit had shut down. That meant that Mark needed to keep the entire thing cool until it was up and running again, and the best way to do that was to put the reefer inside another refrigerated container. Luckily for Mark, all of this was happening during the day, when most community arenas were unoccupied and available for rent. When he arrived at the Newton Arena in Surrey, the arena attendant was waiting outside for him.
Hey, you the guy wanting to rent the rink?
Yes, is it still available?
That's $100 an hour.
Mark didn't like the sound of that at all, but he hoped that when he explained the whole story to Woyake, Better Beef would help him with the cost.
$100 is fine.
You got skates?
No. Actually, could you open the big doors at the end of the rink for me, please?
The attendant scratched his head, but after a shrug, he opened the doors for Mark. Mark drove into the arena and parked Motherlode at center ice, where the temperature at ice level was near freezing. It wasn't cold enough to chill the reefer by many degrees, but at least this way, the air creeping into it would be cold, and the deterioration rate of the load, if any, would be reduced. Not a foolproof plan by any means, but the best Mark could come up with on the fly.
You gonna leave that truck there for very long?
Mark explained to the attendant what was going on. Then, when he was done, he asked the man to call him a cab and take him to the Surrey RCMP detachment.
Sure thing!
Mark finally reached the docks by mid-afternoon, the temperature and the set point on his reefer matching perfectly. At the entrance to the yard, Mark saw the Best Beef truck parked by the side of the road, the driver talking heatedly to a couple of constables from the RCMP. The officers waved back at him, one of them holding Mark's tape in his hand. The Best Beef driver waved as well, but his wave consisted of just a single finger.
Serves you right, you dirty bastard.
If you enjoyed this Mark Dalton adventure, be sure to check out next month's episode featured on the following action-packed titles. Outlanders number 44, Grailstone Gambit. Bloodbond number 12, The Ride for Vengeance. And The Last Gunfighter number 3, Ghost Valley.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, Download That Puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.